The following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
How are we doing back there? Are we still shooting blanks? Okay. Well, let me encourage you. Let me encourage you to this week to work on the next six Psalms, to have your readings taken care of, because here's what's going to happen is as people begin tuning into us on a regular basis on the internet, it's just as though they could sit in Alaska or California or Arizona or Colorado or Minnesota or Virginia or Louisiana or Kentucky or Ohio or any place else in the world for that matter and listen to what's going on here. It's a marvelous thing. I used to think that radio was grand because we could broadcast to everybody within the same Metroplex area. And here we are now being able to broadcast throughout the world. Well, as soon as we figure out what the hiccups are, we'll be able to broadcast to everyone throughout the world. Here's what's going to happen. People are going to begin looking to you as a group, to us as a group, more and more for the leadership of this full Bible movement. And it is becoming a movement. We have churches here and there. I'll grant you, some of those churches are just a handful, and there's just a handful of those churches. But there are full Bible churches around the country today who understand that when God says it, that settles it. And now we must believe it. We have to do it. And are preaching that, you know what? That's not a burden. Isn't that what John says in 1 John? That his commandments are not burdensome. His commandments are the way of life. So you've got one way over here that's kind of narrow. You know, you can't just bounce around and go anywhere you want to. It's a narrow way. But you know, you are convinced that at the end of that path is life. On the other hand, there is another path, and there's a bunch of people on it. I mean, most of the people you'll meet in the course of a day are on that other path. It's broad, lots of folks on it, and you know what? It's way easy. Here are the rules. Do whatever you want. I had a dog like that once. It would do whatever it wanted. Well, actually, it was my parents' dog, but, you know, family dog. And the only way we could get it to mind was to tell it to do what it wanted to. Somebody said, yeah, I've had children like that. The point being, on that Broadway, people get to do whatever they want to. But the end of that path is death. Now, here's what most people are thinking. Now, seriously, quite honestly, most people are thinking this way. Someday, I'm going to get off this path and get on the right one. That's what's going through their minds. But every step they take is a step closer to death and destruction, not a step closer to life. So, I put it to you that there are going to be many, many people, especially now that we have internet broadcasting, that are going to be looking to us for what is the right path? I want to do the right thing. I want to go the right place. I want to be the right kind of people. How do I do that? And you know who they're going to look to? They're going to look to us because they don't have anybody else. You've got a pastor. You've got leadership. There are people out in the hinterlands that have no idea. They're like so many cattle. Don't know their right hand from the left. Jesus talked about the people that were in that situation as being like sheep without a shepherd. And here's what else he told us. Are you ready for this? The harvest indeed is great, but the laborers are few. Now, sometimes we act as though there's not much harvest left and everybody, all the other laborers are getting in my way. But that's not the way it is. There is a huge harvest out there if you're the one who's interested in doing the harvesting. If you're the one who's interested in God raising up laborers, now I'm not talking about idlers, I'm not talking about chatters, I'm not talking about people who just want to live off the fat of the land, who want to shear the sheep rather than feed them. What I'm talking about is actual laborers in the field. God told us to pray for such people like that to be raised up. And I put it to you that maybe, just maybe, one of the reasons there's not more harvest is because there's not enough laborers. Maybe if we were doing more planting, there'd be more harvesting going on. What do you think? It's worth your consideration. Well, last week, by the way, are you enjoying this series on Revelation? Is it something that you feel like you're profiting from? I just think this, the book of Revelation, is one of the most encouraging books in the Bible, rightly understood. Now, if you have no idea what it's talking about, who knows if it's encouraging or not? You know, there are people who wake up in the night screaming because they're afraid of things that they've been told are in the book of Revelation, and that they've been left behind. See, we ought to get rid of that whole left behind mentality and start thinking about right ahead. Right? That's what this book really teaches. What this book really teaches is advancement. Forward. March. Well, last week we began to discuss, or to examine really in some detail, the departure of the old creation. And we compared that at that time to Romans 8, 20-22, that the whole creation groans, waiting for the adoption of the children of God. Then we looked at 1 Corinthians 15 and compared the resurrection of the physical body, of the human body, to the new creation. And we said that there are a lot of parallels. They're the same as to identity. You see, you will be the same person when you're raised on that great getting up morning. You will be the same person. And yet there will be a lot of differences about you. Instead of being corrupt, you'll be uncorrupt. Instead of being mortal, you'll be immortal. There will be a lot of differences about you in that day. So the same in identity, but different as to character and makeup. And I suggested to you that this new heavens and new earth will be much the same way. The same with respect to identity, but new, different, changed with respect to character and makeup. And we concluded last week, I believe, with Philippians chapter 3 and verses 20 through 21, where we read, "For our conversation," that is to say our behavior, our way of life, "is in heaven, from whence," or from where, "also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself." So why do we have hope? At the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, after all the discussion about the resurrection, after all the discussion about how things aren't always going to be the way they are now, Paul comes to a conclusion. He says, "Wherefore," or "therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord." Why? "For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Now, if all of your rewards were going to be given to a totally different person, that would be a strange thing to conclude. So I put it to you that there is an identity of person. There is an identity. You are the same person, and yet you are new in so many ways they can't all be counted. Now, if we move on here in the book of Revelation to verse 2, John joins another idea here. He says, "I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. And he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God." Well, let's see if we can cover these 2.5 verses. When he says, "No more sea," and we're really continuing from last week, when he says, "No more sea," this may well be literal in the eternal state, that there will be no more water, there'll be no more sea in the eternal state. but it also has meaning for us now. There are also some applications that we can take now, and that is this. Well, in fact, a couple. First of all, remember where the beast from the sea came from? That beast that arose and did war against the people of God? The beast from the sea came out of the... The beast from the sea came out of the sea, and there will be no more sea. The implication is there will be no more beasts like him. There will be no... Once God has done away with the wickedness of this present world, there will be no more seas for more beasts to arise. In other words, we'll live with the secure understanding that although there have been enemies in the past, there will be no more enemies in the future. And then also, Revelation 17:1. Again, it's important that we not just take each individual text all by itself. John wrote the entire book, if not in one sitting, he certainly wrote the entire book for us to read in one sitting. And what did he say? Blessed is everyone who heareth and readeth the words of this prophecy and doeth them. Now, if this is only about eternity and it's only about some future generation in which during 7 years an Antichrist is going to rise up, if that's all it's about, there's no blessing for anybody else, is there? There is a blessing for him who hears and reads and does them. Well, if you don't happen to be living in that 7 years, if you're not left behind, then where's the blessing for you? If the book is only about that 7 years. But there are implications and applications for us to make today. If there weren't, there'd be no blessedness from it. And in fact, I've heard people make that very claim, that there's not really much point reading the book of Revelation, just spend all your time reading Hal Lindsey. Well, so I think the first thing that we need to recognize is that the earth is no longer under threat. At the time that Revelation 21 is coming to pass, the earth is no longer under threat. And the sea is considered a threat to the land, to the people of God. In Psalm 46, for example, 3 and 6, we sing that the mountains are cast into the sea. All right, turn there. Some of you are looking at me with a certain degree of skepticism. That's fine. That doesn't offend me at all. It doesn't even displease me. Psalm 46, verse 3, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, and though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, verse 6, the heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved, he uttered his voice, the earth melted. What I want you to see there is that the sea represents, first of all, the nations round about the people of God, and secondly, that when the people are threatened, it is as though the sea threatened us, as though the mountains were going to shake, as though the sea was going to come pouring in upon us. But in the time in which Revelation 21 is speaking, there is no longer a threat from the sea, no longer a threat from the nations. Do you see that? Okay, moving on. That's just a conclusion from last week. So I say, well, how did he get there? Go to last week's notes. The next thing I want us to see, and in my notes, it's Roman numeral 3. If you're just taking notes today, it'll be Roman numeral 2. My Roman numeral 1 is in last week's notes. So Roman numeral 3, we have a bride adorned for her husband in Revelation 21:2. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. So prepared and adorned. And here we see, I think, the great assembly as it will finally be. Sheep without goats, wheat without tares. You know, we live in a world right now in which there are, in fact, goats among the sheep, aren't there? The way Augustine said it was, there are many sheep without, many wolves within. And he's got a point, doesn't he? I mean, we look at some of the greatest enemies of the gospel, and where do we find them? Inside the camp. inside the camp. That's why we said in Numbers chapter 5 that it's not just the enemies out there we need to be concerned with. We need to make sure that they can't get in, but we also need to make sure that the people that defile are put out. And we're going to talk about abominations before we're finished here with Revelation 21. But abomination is a very important word when it comes to the camp of God. Remember, there is an abomination that desolates. That's an abomination up with which God will not put. And he will desolate the church rather than have that abomination in it. There is an abomination of desolation. We'll talk about that. Not today. But in the New Jerusalem, in the Holy City, in the city that descends down from God, there will be no tares among the wheat. There will be no goats. There will be no, well, there will be nothing that abominates. A couple of things I want you to see. In Isaiah chapter 26, and again, I can't help thinking that there would be a much better understanding of the book of Revelation today if people would just take the time to read the Old Testament first. You know, it's really hard to go to the last chapter of a book and then figure out what that last chapter is telling you if you haven't read the rest of the book first. So Isaiah 26:3, listen to some of the imagery that we bring forward from the Old Testament. Pardon me, 26:1. In that day shall this song be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. So what are going to be the walls of the city in that day? Salvation. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. You know what the bulwark is? That's the part where you walk around the wall. In Isaiah 49, that is to say, chapter 40, verse 9. I say that because we are going to come back to 49 later. But in chapter 40 and verse 9, O Zion, you know where Zion was? That was a hill in Jerusalem. O Zion, that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem, that bringest good tidings. And by the way, we've had the word good tidings here twice. Do you all know what the English word is, one word for good tidings? Gospel. Well, you can hear it kind of in the German, the Gutspiel, right? It's the good news. It's the good tidings. It's the glad tidings. And the word that is translated here as good tidings might just as well be translated as gospel. In fact, in Greek, that's exactly what the word is. Do you know what the evangel is? It's the good news, isn't it? The euangelion or evangelion is the good news, the gospel, the evangel. So when we do evangelism, what are we doing? We're gospeling. We are bringing good tidings. So, O Jerusalem, that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength, lift it up, be not afraid, say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Now, this is not talking about physical Jerusalem. Physical Jerusalem was a city, not a people. It's speaking to the people of God considered as a city. What do we call that? Personification? Is that when you talk about a thing as though it were a person? Is that called personification? Some of you poets help me out here. Personification. So God is here personifying the hill Zion on which the temple was built. He's here personifying the city of Jerusalem. And that's basically what he's doing also in Revelation 21, isn't it? That she's coming down from God. She is prepared. She's adorned like a bride for her husband. And then one last place, and that's Psalm 48. And I'm not sure when was the last time we sang that. I guess a couple months ago. In Psalm 48, and I'm going to read all three verses to you. Verses 1, 2, and 3. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king, God is known in her palaces for a refuge or for salvation. For a refuge. So we have here then, don't we? We are the New Jerusalem. We are the ones who are preaching. We are the ones who are gospeling. And what are we saying? What do we say? We say, behold your God. And God is known in her palaces for a refuge. Do you know God is a refuge? Do you know that God is your salvation? Well, that's the question. Yeah, amen is the answer. But the question is, do you know God as your salvation? Do you have God as your refuge? God is known in her, that is to say, in the New Jerusalem, God is known as her refuge. Two things very briefly. I want you to see that it's coming down from God. We have that not only in 21:2, but also drop down a little bit at 21:10. It says the same thing. This is, I believe, as opposed to the city of man. In fact, remember I told you last week we need to compare the two different cities, the harlot and the bride? And the one is Babylon, or also known as Babel. Now, what famous structure was built in Babel? Who can think of a famous structure that was built in Babel? The tower, exactly so. And what did they say when they built the tower? Genesis 11:3 or 11:4. Go to, let us build a tower that will reach up to heaven. In other words, man's religion is, let's do something to get to God. God's religion is, he did something to get to us. The difference is coming down out of heaven versus building up to heaven. It's the city of man versus the city of God. It's the city of the harlot versus the city of refuge, the bride. And there is safety and permanence. I think we see that in the wall. Remember how, you may remember, as we went through Leviticus, say this is click, 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 store things away, right? Put them in memory so we can draw them out later. A wise steward puts things in the storehouse so he can have new stuff and stuff out of the storehouse, right? So we stored it away back then. Now we're going to pull it out. Click, click, click. What's the difference between a walled city and an unwalled city in the Holy Land? In a walled city, you cannot lose your inheritance. In the unwalled city, you can sell it off. You can get rid of your inheritance. You can sell it to the next guy. You can say, hey, Joe, would you like my inheritance? It's all yours. Inside the walled city, it has to come back to you in the year of Jubilee. So it's not a mistake. It's not simply a, oh, well, let's think about a really nice city. It'll have a wall. It's the fact that it has a wall that lets us know that our inheritance is completely safe and completely secure in that New Jerusalem. It's a high wall. By the way, we're going to do the measurements later. You're going to be surprised at the measurements because it's altogether larger than the Holy Land. It's bigger than Texas. It's basically 1,400 miles north to south, 1,400 miles east to west, and 1,400 miles straight up. Well, now, maybe that's literal. But if it is, I'll guarantee you there's no more sea. Because about 7/8 of it would be out in the Mediterranean. So, what does that mean, 1,400 miles straight up in the air? I mean, you would have satellites knocking into it. So what does that mean, 1,400 miles? It means that your salvation, your inheritance, is altogether secure inside the city of God. Now, you get outside the city, I'm not saying that. But inside the city of God, your salvation is altogether secure, altogether safe. Also notice that the city is prepared and adorned. A preparation of a bride is thorough. We're going to have a bride here in less than 2 weeks, yes? Wow. Congratulations again. Preparation of a bride is thorough. She leaves her father's house. She goes through the expenditure, or her father does, of a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of money, typically. What kind of an application is there for us? Well, how are you using the talents that God has placed on loan with you? Do you know how much a talent is, by the way? I know we tend to think in terms of, oh, talents, that means abilities. No, it doesn't. It's a measure of weight. A talent in biblical days is a measure of weight. So when he gave a talent to this guy and 5 talents to this guy and 10 talents to this guy, do you have any idea how much he's giving them? It's almost 100 pounds of gold per talent. Now that's a lot to entrust with somebody, isn't it? How are you going to use it? How are you going to prepare? How are you going to make use of what God has placed in your hands? Now, you can use it any way you want. God's not going to stop you. You might get in a car wreck if you get a Jaguar. You might get in a car wreck if you get a Pinto. But the point of it is, how you use it is up to you. But how the rewards are given to you at the end of time is due to how you use it. It's a result of how you use what God has placed in stewardship with you. Now, I think his provision for us is far more than we ever get. And here's why. We stop up the channels of blessing. We stop up the channels of blessing by not asking for things as we ought, by not asking for enough things, by sinning, by using them incorrectly or foolishly. We stop up the channels of blessing a lot of ways. And that's why I say I think God has provided a lot more for us than we ever get. But whatever that provision is, he's measuring it in 100 pounds of gold. Well, that's more gold than a lot of us have. So I'm thinking that there must be a lot more provision there than most of us are making use of. Well, a bride prepared for her husband, adorned for her husband. And by the way, how many of you have seen that movie or that picture or that vision of a Middle Eastern bride where she has all the coins hanging from her dress and they're carrying her around on a chair and the coins are just jangling? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Have you seen anything like that? You know, some of you have seen something like that. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine it with me? That she just, you know what that is? That's her dowry. And basically what she's showing is how rich a bride she is. How she's been adorned, not by her father. You see, in Western civilization, the dowry is brought into the marriage, into the wedding, into the picture by the bride and her father. Biblically, the dowry is brought into the wedding by the bride, by the groom. Are you with me? That's why when David had to pay a dowry for Michal, Saul's daughter, Saul prescribed it would be 100 foreskins of Philistines. When Jacob had to bring a dowry for Rachel, Laban indicated it would be 7 years of labor. So now, the brother in one case, the father in another case, but the male who was in charge of, who was the head of that woman, prescribed the dowry, but the groom brought the dowry. Okay, that's why she is adorned, not just for her husband, but also by her husband. So all the riches, now think about this, all the riches then that the bride of Christ has comes from Christ. They all come from the bridegroom. Someday I'm going to preach a sermon to you that I've preached before, not in your presence. It's probably been 20 years since I've preached it, on Christian marriage. And I've already promised that I'm not going to do much preaching at the wedding, so it won't be there. But sometime in the near future, I'm going to preach on biblically what actually takes place during a wedding. And here's what you're going to find out. Most of what we do in the Western church is wrong. So this whole portion of Scripture, chapter 21 and chapter 22, really I think the whole book of Revelation, but especially now as we come into Revelation 21 and 22, this portion of Scripture is designed to lift your spirits and to give you hope. See, Pastor, if you knew my situation, you would realize that it's going to be really difficult to give me hope. You know what? I have to work for the man, and I'm deeply in debt, and I drive an old car, and my house, I need a new roof, and, you know, I'm having trouble getting my kids to do anything I say. You don't know my life. If you knew my life, you would know. And there may be hope for other people, but there's no hope for me. See, here's what the book of Revelation is teaching. If the whole world is standing against you and telling you that you can't even buy or sell without selling out, God is still for you. There's still hope. No matter how bad things appear to you, to God, it's a sea as smooth as crystal glass. It may look turbulent to you, but God can teach you to walk on water. Now, I'll grant you, if you're going to walk on water, you've got to get out of the boat. But you can walk on water. If you understand that the book of Revelation is designed, it's here for the purpose of giving you hope. So that you can understand that the future belongs to you. The future doesn't belong to the devil. The future doesn't belong to those that are left behind or those that are going on ahead or those that are raptured or those that stay behind. The future belongs to you. The future belongs to those who read and hear and obey. That's who the future belongs to. And that's what this section and this book is designed to teach you, to lift your spirit, to remind you, you know what? It doesn't look like there's much hope. It doesn't look like there's a light at the end of the tunnel, but God says there is. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, even if I have to look in God's Word to find it. It's there. And the fact that you can't see it is neither here nor there. You can't see atoms either, but they've convinced you that they exist, right? You can't see germs, but they've convinced you they exist. Okay, so you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So what? God says there's a light at the end of the tunnel, so there is. You just need to keep on moving forward. If you go back, you'll never see the light at the end of the tunnel. You'll be like Lot's wife. Think about how sad those three words are. Remember Lot's wife. All she did was look back to take one last peek. All I wanted was a farewell. All I wanted to do was wave to my friends. And what happened to Lot's wife? She was turned to a pillar of salt. Remember Lot's wife. Well, then there's a loud voice. I have 10 minutes. We're going to talk about a loud voice for 10 minutes. We're not going to have time to do the loud voice, the great voice, the megalo voice. We're not going to have time to do it. But I want you to understand that it's telling us some very important things. Listen to this. The tabernacle of God is with men. That's the thing you have to remember. Where does God live? He's not in some faraway heaven out there. Well, yes, He is there, but you know where else He is? He's right here. In fact, that is the nature of Christ's favorite name. People go to Isaiah 7:14 and they say, oh, a virgin shall give. And they say, that word means virgin. No, no, no. That word means young maiden. No, 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 no. It means virgin. No, 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 no. It means young maiden. And they miss the whole point of Isaiah 7:14. His name is Emmanuel. His name is God with us. It's a small thing that a virgin gives birth to a child then. The big thing is God is with us. And you're going to argue over a small thing like whether she's a virgin? Of course she's a virgin. But so what? The important part is God is with us. Don't miss the important stuff. And that's what the great voice says. The big, loud voice comes booming into John's ears and he says, you know what? The tabernacle of God is with men. Let me show you something very quickly and we'll close with this. This will kind of give you a hint about what's coming. This is previews of coming attractions. In John chapter 1 and verse 14. Now, before we get there, as you're turning, let me remind you, or if you didn't know, tell you, teach you, that in the Greek language, the word for tabernacle or temporary tent is skene. How would we spell that? S-K-E-N-E, I guess. Skene. Now, in John 1:14, here's what John has done. He's taken the word for tent or tabernacle specifically, and he's turned it into a verb. Have you ever seen a noun be verbified? Or verbalated? That's what he's done, is he has verbed a noun. And now in verse 14, and the word was made flesh, and you see that word dwelt? He tabernacled among us. He dwelt. He pitched his tent among men. What did that tent look like? It looked just like Jesus. And it did not look like a bearded lady. Whatever Jesus looked like, I know this. He looked like a man. He didn't look like some long-haired hippie creep in a dress. He looked like a man. That means that he had short hair. How do you know he had short hair? Because it's a shame for a man to have long hair. And do you know when they shamed him? When they started plucking his beard out. That's when they shamed him. Up until that point, he had no shame. That means he had no long hair. He was a man's man. This is a guy that would get up in the morning and walk for 14 or 15 hours and then sit down at night and start teaching. That's a man's man. This is a guy that would get out and swing a hammer with the best of them. Whether he was a stonemason, whether he was a carpenter of wood, the word means tradesman. The guy got out there and built some sinews swinging a hammer. He was a man's man. He knew how to use a sword, and when his disciples said to him at the end of his earthly ministry, well, we've only got two swords, he said, well, maybe that'll be enough. He didn't tell them, well, you know, go put them away and become pacifists. You know, that would have been a good time when they said, we've only got two swords. He said, take those two swords and sell them. He'd told them that before, hadn't he? He said, if you've got swords, sell the swords. Buy yourself a cloak, head on down the highway. Not now. Now, keep the sword and head on down the highway. One last thing I want to say, and that is that this is the reality of the Christian life. What I'm talking about right now, Christ among us, Christ with us, this is the reality of the Christian life. We can talk all around the edges. But until we get back to Jesus, we're not really talking about the central teaching of Christianity. You see, honest to goodness, if we did not believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we'd be better off as Jews. We'd be better off converting to Judaism and meeting in the synagogue. The thing that differentiates us primarily from synagogue Jews is this: Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And here's what Jesus said when Peter told him that. He said, well, Peter, you know, there's a lot of opinions out there about who I am. Who do you say I am? And Peter said, I know who you are. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, you know what? Flesh and blood didn't teach you that. God taught you that. And on this rock, I will build my church. Not the synagogue of the Jews, the Christian church. the church that recognizes and worships Jesus as God with us. God is making his tabernacle with men. What a marvelous blessing. Let's stand and call upon him.
You have been listening to a sermon by Dr. Richard Bacon of Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed in Mesquite, Texas. For more information on FPCR Ministries, visit our website at www.fpcr.org or contact us by mail at 6702 Dalrock Road, Suite 126, PMB 214, Rowlett, Texas, 75089.